Hello and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Jessie. And today we'll be discussing An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir, the story of Laya, who unexpectedly becomes a spy for the Resistance in order to save her brother, and Elias, a member of the Empire's training school who's fighting to become the next emperor without becoming his mother. Initial reactions.
I couldn't put this book down. It took a few, maybe a chapter or two for me to get interested in it. But then I finished this book and started the second book, A Torch Against the Night. And I finished that one pretty quick too. Like, ignored my partner all day one weekend. And I have A Reaper at the Gates. So I'm probably going to finish that also, in addition to the other books that we're reading for this podcast.
So you won't remember any of it by the time we get there.
I need to take notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't stop, won't stop.
Yeah. Despite how violent this was, it started out a little slow for me, even though we start the book with a child being beaten to death. But I had trouble putting it down once it got started. There was a lot happening. I really fell in love with the characters. I cannot wait to read the next one. And I stayed up way too late finishing the book because I had to know what was happening.
Just like old times.
Just like old times. Like, staying up all night to finish Harry Potter.
Exactly.
Let's start by discussing world building in Through the Wardrobe. So I thought that it was a little weird that they used the Empire and the Resistance. I thought it was very Star Wars-esque or Star Wars-y. And at first it was kind of off-putting, but once I got into the book, it was fine. But that plus Laya's name was really like, wait, what?
It's not Leia.
It's not Leia, but it looks like Leia every time I read it. And when I read it as Leia.
I think it's interesting that the author took these loaded terms and employed them in the novel, and clearly on purpose. Like, why? It definitely was on purpose. And I think it's sort of an intellectual shorthand for the readers, too, because they can think of stories like Star Wars and then bring that background knowledge to the book. But they think of the way those, specifically Star Wars, is a lot less complicated, and that the Empire is purely evil, the Resistance is good. That sort of dynamic is to hear complicates that in the story, because we see that the Resistance also uses people, and that there are people affiliated with the Empire who aren't like entirely evil.
Yeah, or they're like trying to change that, like they don't want to be that thing. And I really liked it didn't feel like Star Wars when I was reading it, but those terms brought that to my mind. Like, immediately, it's what I first thought of, even though I don't really like Star Wars that much.
I fall asleep every time.
Yeah, especially the Empire Resistance ones. I don't remember
most of them. We don't know anything about Star Wars, listeners.
No, except for Kylo Ren.
The world building came across as very connected to the Roman Empire for me, and not just in the sense of this need to constantly expand and conquer and dominate. I also saw some connections in the more detailed aspects of the world building, like the names of the different groups and how they interact with each other. And bear with me, because I'm going to do a little listicle. So we have the Marshals, who are the ruling group, ethnic group, We'll talk about that in One Does Not Simply. But the Marshals are divided into royal families, which are called the Illustrians, and then the Plebeians, which I think the name speaks for itself. They're the lower classes.
Yeah.
And the familial names and snippets of culturally significant words that we hear are Latin or Latin-derived, like Gens Aquila. I think that's how you pronounce that.
It's what I assumed.
Pater and Mater for each family figurehead. Antium is the capital city. The last names sound like Latin-derived. And then we have the scholars, who are supposedly obsessed with knowledge. Their land is located to the south. They seem to be darker skinned. And it reminded me of sort of Northern Africa, Library of Alexandria sort of society. And the barbarians are to the north, which is also depicted as cold. And this is what the Germanic tribes were called for the Roman Empire. And then even the wild men further north and east, which could be like maybe the Celtic people from the British Isles, because the Roman Empire also expanded that far. And I'm not saying this to like simply graft on empirical history onto the story, but I just thought it made me nerd out. I thought it was fun to see the different connections.
I didn't know any of that stuff till you wrote it in the show notes. And I was like, oh, wow, Kelly really did. She did lots of research and she knows what, I guess you already probably knew all these things a little bit. I didn't think of any of those things when I was reading it.
I thought of it immediately when I was like all the mater and pater and the gens. And I was like, oh, maybe it comes from all the romance languages I speak, which are Latin derived.
Right. Because I was like, gens, I don't know what that means.
I mean, like gente is the word for people in Spanish.
Oh.
So it's like a lot of different Latin roots. And I was like, oh, I see it.
Your study of language has come in handy.
It has.
I thought this world did a lot of nature versus nurture with Elias and Lya as they deal with the legacy of their parents. Elias is trying to figure out, like, is he going to be I'm going to say bad person, but is he going to become his mother because he's born from her? Or does having grown up with the tribesmen and does that change, like, who he'll become as an adult? And then we see it with Lya with her parents. For some reason, she identifies more with her mother than her father, and she thinks it's important to be brave like her mother.
Who is called the lioness, I guess, yeah. In the resistance.
And she wasn't raised by her mother for most of her life, so she's also kind of struggling with like who she'll be as a person, as a descendant of her mother. So I thought this book dealt a lot with the question of, are we destined to become our parents, and what shame, if any, should we have for their actions? Because we see both of them dealing with the good and the bad things that their parents did and whether or not they bear any responsibility for that.
Yeah, and whose responsibility it is then moving forward. Like, as far as healing, I don't know if anyone's thinking about healing. They're probably just thinking about overthrowing the empire at this point. But yeah, who has, I guess, like, looking forward, who's going to be the main force turning the wheel? Like, who's actually going to be in charge?
Which is interesting because it's so opposite of Children in Blood and Bone, where they're trying to deal with, like, are the children the ones responsible for the healing that their parents caused? This book seems to, like, deal with it a little differently in that the children are directly taking on that healing process a little bit.
Does that, yeah, make sense? I think there's more of a, well, in Children in Blood and Bone, I think there is an identification, at least with Zaylee, an identification with the, like, her mom who died and wanting to be like her. And same with Lya.
Right.
She also identifies with her mother who died and wants to be like her. Mm-hmm. Versus Inan is trying, like, thinks he wants to be like his father and then thinks he doesn't want to be like his father. Right. And then ends up going back to the dark side, to continue the Star Wars metaphor.
Yeah.
And then Elias is trying super hard not to be like his mother. Right. So we do have a similar tension about, like, who are the aspirational figures in our lives and how are we going to determine how, is that going to determine how we act?
Right. Yeah, your parents don't have to be who you want to become. And I guess we see that with Elias. He does not, like, that is his goal in life, is not to become his mother, which is also kind of sad. He has such a bad mom.
She hates him a lot.
She does hate him. She's awful. We'll talk about her in villains.
Speaking of his mother being awful,
this book was so, so violent.
There are 3 exclamation points.
Yeah.
In the episode script.
It could really give Game of Thrones a run for its money, I think, which is saying a lot. And as a YA book, I am more and more surprised as time goes on how much more, like, violent and sexual they become. I'm not sure it's a bad thing. It's just mature for an audience that ranges from, like, 13 to, I guess we'll say 19, because that's the end of your teenage years.
Yeah, I would say that I have seen that kind of recently. It's sort of this tendency towards more overt sexual content and more overt graphic depictions of violence. And I think that that's actually, it might be a result, or partially a result, of more diverse authors now publishing YA, because those sorts of things are happening to people. It's just, like, I don't know, cushy, like, people who have more, like, white people have more privilege, and the people who are traditionally the makeup of YA authors aren't dealing as much with those things on a systemic level as people from other communities. So as far as, like, young women experiencing violence, It happens all the time.
Right.
And also young people having sex happens all the time.
Yes, it does. Yeah. I think it maybe started for me reading Sarah J. Maas. And I was surprised, like, A Court of Mist and Fury, I won't give anything away. Well, I guess A Court of Thorns and Roses, too. Just how much sex was in them. And they're violent. Throne of Glass is violent.
There's a lot of sex in that, too.
Yeah, is there?
Later on in the story.
Yeah, that's true. I don't remember that one as well. But I think it's just surprising to me a little bit. But yeah, this is a very, very violent world.
The violence didn't strike me as gratuitous in the same way that Game of Thrones is. I don't know what you thought about that
This book. I don't think so. The problem... So I only read the first Game of Thrones book, and then I have watched the TV show. And the show is very violent, but often for no reason. And in this book, none of the violence... There was never not a reason for it. Like,
I mean, we aren't in a school for assassins.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Number one.
Yeah. So I don't really expect much less.
And it didn't strike me. It seemed like it made sense with the world building, I guess, in An Ember in the Ashes is what I was thinking.
Right.
And then it certainly plays out this human tendency to equate violence with power and vice versa, to use violence for power.
Yeah. And I think maybe Game of Thrones doesn't do as well with this because, I don't know, there's something about it that the violent just seems, or even sometimes, like, there's a lot of rape in Game of Thrones, seems unnecessary. Like, it doesn't move your plot forward. So why did you need to do that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Maybe part of it is the visual medium, too, the show. Because I had a similar, like, experience watching Outlander.
Mm-hmm.
Just a lot of, apparently the only interesting thing, the conflict that can happen to a woman is, like, sexual assault.
Yeah, and I think sometimes those shows and books get away with that because they set them in one in fantasy worlds, or two in worlds that are so long ago that people have the excuse of like, oh well, that's what it was like. It's like, well, was it? One, and two, how does this matter to your plot? How does this move the story forward? And if it doesn't, then it's probably not necessary.
Yeah, and I didn't have that as much of that impression with An Ember in the Ashes. It seemed quite justified.
I think especially maybe because Elias is dealing a lot with trying not to be as violent. Like, he's really trying to, like, rein in his anger and fury about, I mean, everything, really. So we see someone grappling with how violent the world is. And I think maybe that makes a lot of a difference.
Yeah, I'd say so. Wands out. This is a segment where we discuss all things magic.
I think the magic in this book was more subtle than what we've read in previous books. We get some mythical and magical creatures like the wraiths and the efrits and the djinn and healing power. Maybe we'll see more magic in future books, but I kind of thought it was cool. I think I was looking for there to be more magic. I think I expected more as a fantasy novel, but I liked it.
I really liked how the magic in An Ember in the Ashes isn't centered around humans. I like that it's something that humans don't possess necessarily, or it's something they can, but only with the influence of these other magical beings. The magic's much more otherworldly. It gives you like this beyond the veil sense, like it's both of this world and not of this world. I think it created a sort of like ethereal vibe.
Right. How do you think Helene got her healing power then?
Do they not say that in the first book?
Oh, I guess. No, I have no idea.
I think I know how, but I think I know because of the second book.
Okay.
The augurs might be an exception to what we just said about the magic not being human.
Right.
Or not directly connected to humans, because they can see futures, plural being important, and they basically have legitimacy. Because they can read people's minds. They say it's not reading, but it basically is.
I mean, isn't that what Snape says in Harry Potter 2? It's not mind reading, but I mean, that's what you're doing.
But you're in there and you know what people are thinking.
You're looking around in there. You're basically reading it. I thought was it really interesting, the story of the augurs and how they stole their powers. So they're immortal because they stole knowledge from the djinn. But I guess you know more than me.
Is that how they got their powers?
I think that's what they said. There's like a whole story where I think. Oh
no, where? This is the scholars.
Oh yeah,
in their thing against the djinn.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe now I don't know.
That's what why I thought the augurs were interesting, is because I didn't get the sense that they got their powers from otherworldly beings. They are all of a sudden just immortal.
Yeah.
And they just are omnipotent. And so it struck me as a little bit of an outlier, at least in the magical system, as far as we see it in the first book. And the augurs, language nerd note, augurio is the Spanish word for omen. So the augur name being derived from the same root makes total sense. Also, thanks to the internet, I learned that augurs are priest-like figures who actually existed during Roman times, and they practiced augury, which is interpreting the future based on birds' flight patterns, like what kind of bird is flying, how many birds are flying, what direction are they flying, are they making noises while they're flying. This is called reading the auspices. So if something's auspicious, that's where the term comes from. And then the augury in Fantastic Beasts, the J.K. Rowling, is a bird that sings when it's going to rain.
Wands away. Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good and evil in our segment called Get Me Kylo Ren. So the commandant.
...
She is just all around evil, bad person, bad mother,
so dark and twisty.
Yeah. I mean, I do have the smallest amount of empathy for her, because she didn't want to have Elias, and she did everything she could to try and get rid of him. But I don't know. He was a baby. Can you imagine just leaving a baby? I mean, I guess the story he knows wasn't true. She didn't leave him to die. Well, that one was hard.
Very conflicted about motherhood in general.
Right.
And then, I mean, I guess it's tough to think about, but why access to safe legal abortion is important.
Right. Well, and that's the crazy thing that's the strange thing for this book, is that she did all the things that were possible for her to try and abort the baby, and none of it worked. I guess it's because, I'm guessing, Elias is the one who was foretold or whatever, so maybe fate intervened and she can't.
Yeah, that could be. I don't know. But she is the epitome of a villain, though.
Yeah, like I said, my empathy for her is the tiniest amount, because really, she's awful. She's an awful person.
Yeah. I mean, she certainly acts that way. I find myself wanting to know more about her backstory. I'm a sucker for a villain backstory. Love them.
I also want to know who Elias's father is.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Do you think he's a tribes person?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
There's a thing that happens at the end of the second book that you'll have to wait for.
Okay. This is why you don't read ahead.
I'm sorry, I couldn't stop.
I get it. Okay, well, he seems to fit in well with the tribes people. So my guess is that his father was a tribes person.
I'm not sure if I have any hope for Karis Veturia as far as falling in love and I don't know. Maybe it was just a tryst.
Yeah. Once I start to hate a villain, I really hate them. And I'm okay, I'm ready for her to die now. And I hope Elias does it.
I mean, or it could be Helene. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know. The Helene and Karis seem not exactly foils for one another, but they do seem
foil adjacent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They are connected. I see. I don't know. I see Helene could turn into Karis, but I'm not sure that she will.
I think that's what we're supposed to see. She, between her and Elias, she is the person who's most likely to turn into Karis, and she's going to have to make a choice about that. But it's hard because from where I'm standing, she has to follow all of Marcus's commands or Elias will die.
Yeah, she's in a tough spot. We have to talk about Blackcliff and how it's a boarding school that kills half of its students.
It's funny because I feel like we get a lot of books in YA that are assassin schools, or they're like training people to be soldiers. We'll see this a little bit once we read the Mortal Instruments, which Kelly has not read yet.
And they're coming up, listeners.
But when you think about it more literally, like, they're teaching people how to murder people. Like, children, yeah. How to murder people.
They're murdering children and then teaching children how to murder other people.
Yeah.
This is quite problematic.
It's a real harsh environment, too. Laia thinks that Elias's room is a cell, like a jail cell, which is, that's really bad. And really, it's just a sad place to be.
Well, for him, it basically is. That's why he, like, digs the tunnel behind it.
Yeah, that's true. But I imagine, like, everyone's room looks similar. And she's in, like, in a small, like, a cupboard, basically. And she still thinks, like, his room is a cell, which is, it's just so sad.
Telling of how, like, bleak it must be there. Yeah.
It makes me feel so bad for Elias. I'm not sure I'm supposed to feel as bad for him as I do, but I'm just, like, I can't imagine being, like, taken from the only home you know and you love to be forced to become the person you hate.
And also, these children are 6 when they're taken.
And, like, rounded up into a pen of other children, and they said, like, half of them die.
And, yeah, if they survive, then they get to go to Blackcliff and then potentially, like, then face death basically every single day.
Right.
Until graduation.
In what world is this okay, you know?
It's, like, that sort of preserving the empire at all costs sort of logic.
Yeah.
I guess.
I don't know how someone's government becomes so important to them that they think, let's just start killing kids, you know?
I don't know.
That's a lot.
That's really far down a very dark path. Speaking of the Empire.
Yeah, the Empire chooses to oppress the scholars by taking away their ability to read, so they're not allowed to teach next generations how to read. And obviously they're doing it in secret because Laia knows how to read. Her grandparents taught her how. Or maybe her parents.
I'm curious. I didn't get a sense for how long that had been going on. But because it seemed to be very common knowledge among the marshals that the scholars couldn't read, they just assume that none of the scholars can read. So I get the sense that it's been going on for generations at least.
Yeah, because Laia's parents are in the resistance. I assume they're not supposed to read either. But it's kind of a little confusing because Laia's grandfather is a doctor. So you would assume, like, he would have to know how to read. So maybe her parents' generation.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. But I thought it was an interesting way to oppress a group of people. Because what you're essentially doing is taking away their ability to gain knowledge. And their ability to, like, move up in the world.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of more oppressive regimes specifically crack down on universities.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you gain more knowledge, then you're more likely to see other ways of other, you know, possibilities for living in the world. And then that leads to revolt and revolution.
Because I think learning leads to you questioning authority figures, which means questioning your government. So it makes sense that they would take that away, but also obviously it's not working at all.
And what's interesting then is that the Empire also took the knowledge of their steel making,
mm-hmm.
because the superior weapons are the key to the Empire's dominance, and it's Sarek steel. That's what we keep hearing.
Right.
And so this is stolen knowledge that they're using. Scholar created. And I don't know, I just thought that was an interesting point about how they took the knowledge from them and then imposed ignorance on those people in order to stay dominant, probably because they're severely threatened,
right? Especially if the scholars could figure out a way to make Sarek steel, they can probably figure out a way to make something better,
which is the whole reason that Laia's brother Darren has been captured,
right? Oh, right.
It's because of his connection to Sarek steel.
Mm-hmm. To the Telumon?
Telumon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blacksmith. Another thing I want to talk about in the villains in Get Me Kylo Ren is the resistance not being purely good. So supposedly we learned from Leia that the resistance supposedly lives by this code of honor called Izzat, which again, thanks to the internet, is a real thing from northern India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan that translates across Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh religions. But the cook's perspective shows Leia and the readers that the resistance is far from perfect. They use people just like the Empire does. And this sent me down memory lane thinking about grad school and reading Immanuel Kant's writings on morality, and which is encapsulated in this thing called the categorical imperative, where he says that, you know, it's immoral to use people as means. They should only be ends. And it's basically two competing ideologies. But I'm just not sure I think if you're really trying for revolution, it's inevitable that people get used as means.
Right. The problem is, for resistance, is that I think it's hard to create a revolution without anyone getting hurt and without using people. We see this with Mazen. The hard part is, I'm not sure that Mazen's not the one who's the traitor of Leia's parents. Your smirk tells me that you know who it is.
I'm sorry.
Don't tell me. Anyways, I'll just pretend that you don't know. Because everything he does with Leia is a lie. Like, I don't know what he really wants from her. And obviously you can't say, because you probably know.
I think I read the second book too fast to really remember the details. True confessions.
Yeah, the resistance, there's a lot of bad people there, and I think Mazen is the one, because I think Leia thinks that maybe the cook is the traitor for a little bit, because she says she's the only one that remembers her parents, but I think she forgets about Mazen in that equation, and how when her parents were gone, he took over. And maybe that's what he wanted all along.
Yeah, the struggle for power within the resistance could certainly turn out to be a storyline that we see going forward.
Yeah.
We don't know that much about its makeup and what they were. I mean, we know what they were striving for, but we don't really know how it operated. We just get tiny glimpses here and there.
Right, and I'm not 100% convinced that Mazen's not working with Karriss, the commandant.
Mm-hmm. I think Karriss is so smart. She's probably just using everyone.
She probably is. But if he was the traitor, and if he's the reason she knows when they have a spy, I wouldn't be surprised. He seems like a bad dude.
Shady.
Yeah, super shady.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Are the Augurs villains?
I struggled with them for a bit because they know the future, but they're not willing to change it. I don't know if they're bad or if they are, like, for some reason not allowed to change the series of events. I think that everything they do has led to bad things for the most part. And I think they're straddling that line between villain and not hero, but just villain and not villain. And if you know these things are going to happen, like, why not just tell Leia that she's going to have to save Elias? Like, it was frustrating.
Yeah, I found them super frustrating, and I think that's the point, right? I think as readers, we're supposed to find them frustrating.
Our characters find them frustrating.
Yeah, that too. But I was also struggling with it, and then I just had this light bulb go off one time, and I'm like, wait, they are 100,000,000% invested in furthering the project of this, like, genocidal colonial power.
Yeah.
So, villains, bye.
Yeah, they're like complicit. They're not doing anything to stop it, even though they know what's going on, because they're so concerned with making sure that the future that they see is the one that happens in the end. But they don't care about the people who get hurt in the process, because...
No, they're actively manipulating it so that it happens.
And they can't die, so I think the consequences are too low for them to care what happens to anyone else.
They're definitely using people as means.
Yeah.
Kant would not approve. Jesse, did you know that one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender? This is our segment on power, bodies, and how they relate. There is such an obvious rape culture in this world. It was honestly hard for me to read sometimes. It's in the language. They say son of a whore a lot. It's incredibly prevalent in the everyday social interactions, like the students at Black Cliff raping slaves, and that's just common knowledge. There's a lot of rape.
Yeah.
Or the suggestion that it could happen.
I wonder about the author's choice to have so much of this in there, and maybe she's making a statement about how prevalent rape is in our culture, even though it doesn't seem like it on a day-to-day basis, because I also don't think we normally get YA books with so much rape in them.
Yeah, that's a good, I hadn't thought about that. I think there's definitely a statement here, but I'm just not quite 100% sure what it is.
Yeah, but I guess it kind of makes sense, because when we think about our culture, there's a lot of slut shaming in our culture. We say son of a bitch, which is also not...
It's the same thing, basically. Yeah.
Basically the same thing. I wonder if she's just making it more obvious by making the words sound worse because they're not the ones we normally use.
Totally. Yeah, they're not the normalized terms. Right. So that they're going to be more impactful for us as contemporary readers.
Right.
I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. And I think we see less... at least in the United States, because one, we don't have slaves in the traditional sense of the word, so we don't really see as many people being used in the same way as we do in this book.
It's not state sanctioned, right? Beside the prison system.
Yeah, that's why I said not in the traditional sense of the word.
But this is like the slaves don't even have names. I don't know.
I wonder if that's all slaves or just the ones who work for Karis.
It's a good question. I don't know the answer.
We don't really interact with any other slaves, and the commandant / Karis, is that a position she holds?
Yeah, it's the head of Blackcliff.
Okay. She is seen as being particular. Like the slaver even talks about how often she kills her slaves. So I do wonder if...
Or she makes her slaves kill themselves.
Or she took the eye of a 5-year-old with Izzy. So I wonder if some of those things are made worse because she's in charge.
Speaking of the commandant, there's only one woman allowed at Black Cliff in each generation. This really struck me.
I was really surprised, and I wonder why. I wonder if the augurs know something about a woman who's going to be at Black Cliff, and that's why there's only one allowed at a time.
I'm not sure. I think it's pretty easy for people to just fall into the way things have always been,
mm-hmm.
and then just not change things.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating because, I mean, not that I want them to train more small girls
right.
in the art of murder.
Yeah.
But why one? I just wasn't understanding the logic, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know why it's only one. It's a weird thing to do. And then the one woman from obviously the generation before, Kara, she's in charge of Black Cliff. So that's also surprising in a society that seems so misogynistic that they would let her be in charge of the school.
Yeah, I guess your point about it being misogynistic, and it's a patriarchal system that's not invested in changing the status quo at all, because that would mean relinquishing power and privilege.
Right.
So they put one in there. One woman. They probably don't want fraternizing to happen, but it's okay if they go down to the docks to have sex with the people who are enslaved.
Or just rape them.
Or rape the slaves in Black Cliff.
The interesting thing about Karis is that they call her sir. I don't want to say they don't see gender, because they obviously do, but I wonder if they don't want those distinctions to be made even with the one woman who's in the school.
Not allowed to actually be feminine or be a woman.
Yeah. Maybe that's why we see some of the things with Helene that we do.
Well, I'm not sure, though, in our current military, are people called sir if they're, identified as women and they're officers, superior officers? I don't know how it works.
I think they're ma'am, but I'm not 100% sure.
Listeners, if you know.
Yeah.
Let us know.
Yeah, I have no idea. That's a good question. I bet it's ma'am. We're so obsessed with gender binaries in our society.
It could very well be.
I really like how Karis and Laia are seen as like very opposite depictions of women, even though Karis is an abomination as a person. I thought it was amazing to show a wide range of who women are and can be, because Laia is like very maternal. She wants to take care of Izzy. She's trying to take care of her brother. And Karis is like, I don't care who I have to kill. Like, whatever I want is what's going to happen.
Yeah, we don't really know what her motivations are at this point, Karis. I mean, but Laia's are very clear. She's got this like protective instinct. And I totally agree with you. There are a lot of strong female characters, not necessarily good ones. But in addition to Laia and the commandant, we also have Helene, Izzy, and Cook that we see pretty prominent. And then we have the echoes of Laia's mother.
Right.
Also.
I kind of like that they made Karis the villain, because we also don't often get bloodthirsty women villains. So I thought that was also an interesting choice to make, since we don't see it very often.
Yeah, I liked how it flipped the script. Yeah. For sure.
We also see, I think some of this is Helene, maybe because she has been around from the time she was six, like all men, but she has a real hatred of people who are sex workers. Now, I'm not 100% sure that the prostitutes who work in the docks are slaves, or if they're, well, they mention brothels. So I'm guessing it's a choice they've made.
I don't know, but then they said that, remember when Laia is getting, is in with the slaver? And he's talking about like, oh, I could buy you and you'd like, what, you don't want to go work in a brothel? I got the feeling that because slavery is so prevalent, that the majority of them would be sex slaves.
Yeah, that's true. But it's surprising that Helene would draw the line between like a sex slave and a regular slave, a working slave, not a working slave. You know what I mean? She has like this severe hatred for the prostitutes, and it's mentioned in passing, but she has like no feelings about slaves who do work.
Who do other kinds of work that's not sex work. Yeah, right. She doesn't have a problem with slavery, clearly.
No.
She talks to Elias and is like, she's a slave when talking about Laia. It's like, she's a slave. Like, yeah, are you like, serious?
Who cares? Yeah.
But she just hates other women for having sex with men and has no critical thinking whatsoever about whether those women are enslaved or whether like they're actually, if they're doing it consensually.
Right.
She doesn't even care. She just hates that transaction, I guess.
Yeah. And part of it, I guess, might be because she likes Elias, so she doesn't want him, like, having sex with other people. I also thought it was interesting because Helene wants to be equal to the other masks, but she is unconcerned with the rights of anyone else, a.k.a. white feminism. She doesn't care about anyone if it's not part of her group.
That's such a prescient observation that I didn't even put that connection together, but I think you're so right.
Like, she doesn't care about women. In general,
no,
she just cares about herself and the women, I'm guessing, who might come to Blackcliff. Like, she wants them to be treated well, but like Laia is being beaten and she's like, just leave her, it's fine.
She cares about her own family,
right,
and possibly other women at Blackcliff, but also kind of more men.
Yeah,
the men at Blackcliff who are her friends.
Yeah, and even when she sees that, and it's interesting because it's really obvious when we look at her relationship with Marcus, because Marcus is like, Helene thinks that Marcus is gonna rape Laia and she does not care,
even though Helene herself is scared that Marcus will rape her. Like, that was her first trial,
exactly,
is having to, which, like, how fucked up is that?
Those trials are, that's the part where I'm like, the augurs are villains,
totally. But that she had to like experience that in like a semi-dream state.
Right.
And then Marcus is super, like, attacks her, is like super aggressive, and it's that was really disturbing. So like, it's, I think she's a really complex character, right. And kudos to the author for that, right?
Yeah.
Because she's dealing with all this thing, the trauma and this worry and paranoia herself, but at the same time, she's not an advocate,
right,
for other people who aren't like her.
Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating too, because the author did such a good job making her a super badass, like, character. Like, she is very strong. Like, she's taking down these men, like, no problem. But at the same time, she's like an awful person.
Elias's grandfather.
Yeah, he's super badass, like strong elderly man, which I don't think we get depictions of very often. Like the other, like the younger men are scared of him, which was surprising to me. Even though he's pretty bad.
He's a fucking misogynist.
Yeah, he is.
The things he says to Elias about Helene, like around the graduation ceremony time.
Right.
He's like, why are you even messing around with her? Women shouldn't be in the army in the first place.
Right.
And Elias doesn't even try to that hard to push back. And that particularly bothered me. I think because I like Elias's character so much. And I think he said something wishy-washy like, it's not like that. But he's not actually standing up for it. And I just am like, fuck that rolling over bullshit. You didn't say something. You're complicit. Like, with how much privilege and power you have, you're not afraid of what your grandfather's going to do to you. You're, like, the best assassin that's ever lived.
Yeah. I think he's, like, it's hard because I feel bad for Elias. Because I think, like, it's its only, like, loving parental figure he has. So he doesn't want to push him away. But, that, I mean, challenge your parents even if you love them, you know?
Exactly. And Cook is really a badass.
Do we get more? Well, no, don't tell me. I really want to know more about her.
So do
her
I.
Backstory.
Well, we hear about like her torture, her experience being tortured, and oh my gosh, so that was difficult to read.
Do you think Izzy is her daughter?
No, Cook was older when Izzy came.
Oh, okay.
They said that Izzy says that she like got taken from somewhere or something. I can't remember when she mentions that when she's talking about her backstory.
Laya mentions a couple of times how similar they look. And I wonder, I'm like, but why?
Well, they've certainly developed this super close relationship. So Cook might as well be. She's definitely like a parental figure to Izzy.
Maybe more nature versus nurture kind of.
Yeah.
Because Izzy turns out to be pretty strong as well. Like she is not afraid, which is surprising because she's so afraid of Karis, rightfully so, but she's like, yeah, let's just like scale this side of a mountain to like get to this moon festival.
Yeah, that Elias was like, yeah, I tried that one time and almost died.
Yeah, and she's just like, no, it's not that bad.
And these two girls with no equipment and no training are like, whatever, we'll do it.
Yeah, so Izzy's a pretty impressive character, and I was glad to see her come out of her shell. And I'm glad she got saved. Fingers crossed that all works out. Don't tell me. Moving on to race. I didn't think that we got a lot of descriptions of race in this book. It was pretty limited. Similar to other YA novels, we got descriptions of body types, color of hair, and eye color. But the two people we kind of get descriptions of, like, skin color are Karis, who is very pale, and then Elias is described as having golden skin, and I think they do that to like set him apart from Karis, but I'm also like, what does this mean in all capital letters? Like, can you just tell us what people look like? Is Elias supposed to be mixed race? Like, I was frustrated.
I think that's what the novel's implying.
Yeah.
Because it says it focuses on his character description, if I remember correctly, focuses on juxtaposing his eyes, which are supposedly Karis's eyes, but then when you actually look at him, they're not.
Right.
Like they're like a different tone and they're not.
When she has
evil.
Like blonde hair and he has black hair. She's pale, he has golden skin. I just don't know.
I don't know what golden skin means.
I don't either.
And I think you make a really good point because I couldn't quite tell. It seemed like even within the marshals themselves, it seemed like you could differentiate on, like, with phenotypes,
mm-hmm.
like phenotypical traits, the difference between illustrians and plebeians.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it sounded like. Also, at different points in the novel, the illustrians can tell, and it's not just, like, doesn't seem to just be class markers.
Mm-hmm.
They can tell race-wise.
Yeah.
Or at least ethnic group-wise. I don't know. So I was confused about that. And then also the scholars seem to be pretty distinct. It mm-hmm. seems like you can distinguish people based on their phenotypes in this book. But I'm just not clear what the people look like. And I think the only reason I have a picture of Laya in my head as a more, as, like, super, like, darker,
mm-hmm.
As a person of color,
mm-hmm.
like, no questions asked is because of the cover of my book.
Right.
I think it's, I think that's definitely influenced how I imagined her while I was reading.
Right. And my cover doesn't have a person on it. I had no idea what she was supposed to look like. And like, she has dark hair, brown eyes. Like, that could be a lot of different kinds of people. And as I've mentioned lots of times before, I find that really frustrating when they don't just say what people look like.
We mentioned Elias before, and I think it's particularly interesting, this like golden skin ambiguity, mm-hmm. because he grew up with the tribes people, and which are an itinerant people that live in caravans, and they're known for storytelling. So I was getting some like Bedouin, maybe possibly like Roma,
right?
Vibes, mm-hmm. or like possible influences. And Elias isn't even his real name. His real name is Ilyas.
Yeah.
And they make his name whiter,
right,
when they take him to Blackcliff.
Did you look up the name Ilyas?
I did not.
Okay. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting too. And like, the tribes people are kind of looked down on because they're the ones who believe. There's like this distinction between the scholars who believe in like, you know, books and things that are written down, and then the tribes people who have the story of the wraiths, the Ifrits, the djinn, and they're seen as like, it's kind of like this distinction between like knowledge and the supernatural, which I thought was really interesting because we do see that kind of even in our society with like, well, this is science and like science and religion.
The tribes people, that makes me think that the tribes people parallel more indigenous groups, mm-hmm. and tradition, like representations of indigenous groups, because they're more connected to spirituality.
Right. They have an oral tradition.
Exactly. And they're not like, they're nomadic, like mm-hmm. some of the tribes from the U.S. or not from the U.S., from before it was the United States.
Yeah.
Because colonialism.
Yeah.
the Native American tribes and, or, you know, elsewhere.
Yeah.
Indigenous tribes elsewhere. But also they are, yeah, the oral tradition, this, I guess the fact that they're called tribes.
Yeah.
That's obviously very connected to, and like, that's how the makeup of indigenous peoples is articulated, mm-hmm. oftentimes.
Do you think tribes, like, does that mean that they travel inherently, like that word?
No. Okay. I think they can be, like, in one place.
Okay.
Too.
I think of also, like, the tribes of Israel, because they were, like, traveling from Egypt or
mm-hmm.
I don't know, wherever.
But that's interesting about the tribes people. I didn't think about it that way, even though it's kind of super obvious with the name to make that, just to make that connection.
Because Karis left Elias with the tribes people was the other reason I thought, well, maybe his dad was a tribes person.
You could even take this to the forcible removal of indigenous children and putting them in white schools.
That's so true. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. It also makes me a little concerned because there's also like this, the story of indigenous people raping white women. And I worry about how that will move forward with Karis's story.
I really hope it doesn't go down that road.
I hope it doesn't either, but now I'm like kind of worried it will.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Or you already know.
I might know. I don't think I do though. Class distinctions.
Yeah. So there's a pretty obvious class distinction, in this book, or multiple class distinctions, but it seems to be based on the group's role in society. So like the scholars, the illustrians, the tribes people, like they all seem to have like their place within the society that the empire has created post like empire, the
colonial expansion, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
What you say about the hierarchy, I think really highlights the fact that race and class are so intricately tied in right. this particular system.
I think when I was reading it at first, I didn't realize like each group of people looked different as well as had different like roles in their society. But it turns out like each group of people looks a certain way and they have that role in society,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty interesting, but also goes back. Yeah.
And they're also culturally distinct.
Right.
So we have this collapse almost, or we are collapsing race and ethnicity mm-hmm. also.
Question time, Kelly. Okay. Do you think any of the groups can be sold into slavery?
I think any non-illustrian people, yes. So basically, if you don't have class privilege with, and you're not the equivalent of white, essentially, you're right. not a marshal, then I would say yes, because we see a lot of scholar slaves, and that's the group that Laia and Izzy, I get the sense, belong to. I don't really know.
That's why I wasn't sure, because we see a lot of scholar slaves, but I wasn't sure what Cook and Izzy were. Are all of the resistance scholars?
I think it's the scholar resistance, okay, because they're the people being oppressed, right, mm-hmm, in that particular region in Sarah, which is where Blackcliff is. But then I think Izzy mentions that she's from Antium, which is the capital, and that's further north. So she might just be, she might be a marshal, but might be part of the plebeian lower class and sold into slavery.
Yeah, I wonder if there are different levels of class even within each group, like even within the scholars or the marshals.
Probably.
It's pretty...
Well, within the marshals, yes, because they're the illustrians and the plebeians.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly.
But within the scholars, I mean, probably. I mean, yeah. It seems like the tribe people are kind of the only group that we don't get a sense that they're as stratified, I guess.
I think I remember at one point them mentioning that Elias looks different than the other masks. I wonder if he had like difficulties in Blackcliff because he looked different.
I got the sense that he looked different because his mask wasn't bonding to his face.
Right.
And that's because he hates it and he takes it off, whereas everyone else lets that become their identity. They like get themselves erased.
Right. But doesn't, like, if Karis is pale and he's like golden skinned, whatever that means, do the rest of the masks look more like Karis?
I would say probably.
So I wonder if he like stands out in that group, mm-hmm, a bit, you know?
That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
It's hard because he's like the best of the masks. So like, what are they going to do? He's going to be like, fight me. And they'll be like, no, thanks.
Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own.
I like to say that this story has a love square instead of a love triangle. Because we see Kenan and Laia paired together, but then also Laia and Elias, and so Elias and Helene. And I kind of like that we didn't get just your typical love triangle.
I like that too, and I like all the history Elias and Helene had. Mm-hmm. It made their relationship makes a lot of sense.
Right.
But I think he's choosing to be a different person.
Right. I was a little like, it was like really hard reading that one part where he's like, I don't love you, I can't love you that way to Helene. I was like, oh, that had to hurt like real bad.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine?
It's kind of one of those moments where he could have chosen to be with her, but mm-hmm, he didn't. I think that's kind of a symptom of what his larger transformation that he's going through as a character.
Right. He's always making a choice not to be with her. But at the same, he's obviously like sexually attracted to her because he mentions like feelings, but
whatever that means,
whatever you want it to mean.
I think Kenan is a red herring.
Do you say that with knowledge? No, tell me.
No, that was my impression reading the book.
Okay.
I got the, like, it was super, like, sparky. Mm-hmm. Like, they had that moment at the Moon Festival. And there's just, like, she talks about how they smell. Sarah J. Maas does this, too. Talks about, like, how...
That's because boys smell nice when they want
people,
to.
People in general. Yeah, and they have, like, their different colognes that they wear, apparently. And just, yeah, like, the citrus and the... Yeah. I don't know. It was, like, do they...
Sometimes I wonder where authors come up with these, like, smell descriptions. Because I'm, like, citrus? Like, who smells like citrus?
Spicy, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was like spicy. That's hard. Men smell spicy.
Spicy. I just shipped Laia and Kenan from the very, not Laia and Kenan, Freudian slip. I shipped Laia and Elias from the very beginning. They're, yeah, just like the connection, the look. Oh my God, the look. The first look.
Yeah, like that. There's like so much sexual tension between the two of them. And I hope they get sexy times in the next book. Like, I want that for them. But I really liked them getting to know each other, like in the scene where Laia thinks she's like, I don't know what she thinks is going to happen. She's going to be tortured or whatever. And then she's just...
Or raped.
Well, yeah, probably that. But she's just with Elias and they're like talking. I was like, this is like real sweet.
They're just talking.
Like, this is such like a high school romance.
This is sweet.
It was sweet.
In the context of,
yeah,
like,
she's being forced, like she couldn't leave if she wanted
and
to.
And Elias's trial to the death, basically, and they're both sealed together in the room.
Yeah, okay.
But it was, they made the most out of a shitty situation.
Yeah, I ship them, and...
Hard.
Yeah, I feel bad for Keenan, though, because I really do like him, because he really has, like, a good character arc throughout the story, where he, like, comes back around and realizes the Resistance might not be doing the best things. Maybe they'll pair him with, like, Izzy or something.
Oh, yeah, because they're gonna end up, like, Laia sends Izzy to take her spot to freedom, basically.
Yeah.
There are no sexy times.
No, there's not. Just lots of sexual tension.
So much tension.
One kiss.
I am so tense.
I'm so tense. It'll be okay. Maybe next time. I guess you know. Are there sexy times in the next book?
You don't want to know.
You're right. I don't want to know.
Now is a segment that is not Show Us Your Fix. Instead... we're doing, drum roll please,
a segment we have no name for. I don't know, what should we call it?
A segment has no name.
That's a good segment name.
And it's sorting the love square into Hogwarts houses.
All right, let's start with Laia. What house do you think Laia would be in?
Hufflepuff.
Oh really?
Super loyal to Darren. She literally sells herself into slavery, puts herself through torture, all on the hopes of maybe, possibly one day, potentially, maybe seeing her brother again.
Okay, that's a good point. I wanted to put her in Gryffindor because I feel like she's like a Neville-like Gryffindor, where we think she's like frail and weak, but really she's like very brave and strong.
I think that's more Izzy.
But she like runs away, you know? I guess Neville, like, stands up to people. I don't know.
Laia is a Hufflepuff for me.
Well, she's a Gryffindor for me. She can choose. All right, Elias.
What do you think?
Elias is a hard one. I think Elias, because I would say that all the bad people, most of the bad people end up in Slytherin. I know he turns out to be good, but... I think he would be in Slytherin by default because everyone he knows is in Slytherin and he would just join that house. Like, he would be like Snape if Snape were a good person.
I'm not sure anyone in Blackcliffe would, like, that there's the potential that they even open up the potential for being developed into anything besides a villain. Like, they try and stamp that out of you. They try and stamp any goodness out of you.
And that's why I think all of Blackcliffe, like, everyone there would be a Slytherin. And Elias would be there, but he should probably be.
But I don't like that collapsing Slytherin into just villains.
Oh, no, it's awful. Who's a good Slytherin?
Regulus Black?
Yeah, but he joins the dark side first. He's like Elias.
True.
And Snape's just... I don't care what people say. He's a bad person.
Yeah, I'm with Witch, please.
Yeah, he's shitty, and he tortures his students, and...
I don't know. I don't know where he would be. I just don't think that he's ambitious.
No, but he's cunning.
Probably to survive. I don't know if that's more how I think Helene sees the world. I think she's more like epitome. I'm going to bring back white feminism again. Just trying to make it through the institutions that exist and has high aspirations.
So where do you sort Elias then?
Gryffindor question mark?
That's the problem. I think he is a Slytherin who should have been a Gryffindor. Like, Dumbledore thinks that Snape should have, like, we swore too soon. Snape should have been a Gryffindor, even though I think, Dumbledore, you're wrong. He belonged in Slytherin. He's a trash person.
I would say that, yeah, but not all Slytherins are trash people. I don't know. I don't like that. I don't like how, I don't like how it's always collapsed into Slytherin and bad people.
Yeah.
Villain, like, come on. Like, come on. Not you. Like, just J.K. Rowling, basically.
Right. She needs some good Slytherins.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get some in Fantastic Beasts.
Maybe. Oh, yeah. The Newt Scamander's person is a Slytherin, I think.
But isn't she related to the Lestranges?
Yeah. Yeah, she is.
Which is surprising.
I don't know. I like how it complicates the... makes it less black and white or green and... blue, yellow, red. Where do you think Kanan fits?
Kanan's a hard one. I think, I don't know. What do you think?
That's not fair. I asked you first.
I know. I just want all the good people to be in Gryffindor, so I'm going to put them in Gryffindor.
You were so biased.
I like you. You're Ravenclaw.
You like one Ravenclaw. The one you know.
The one that I know.
I think Kanan, he strikes me as Slytherin-y just because he's trying to work his way up the ranks of the Resistance.
Oh, do you think that's what he's trying to do?
Well, I don't know. He positioned it. I kind of got that vibe at the very beginning when Lya is first picked up by the Resistance after she's wandering around in the catacombs.
Yeah. I guess I didn't think that. I think of his end, like, character arc a little more. And so I'm like, he decided to. I guess he probably is this. Yeah, he's probably a Slytherin.
Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment called Kill Your Darlings.
I really like the multiple point of views. Each point of view sounded very different. They tell us at the beginning of the chapter who it is, but we definitely didn't need that. And every time a chapter ended, because some books with multiple POV, they'll do a couple of chapters with a character. And every time we ended a chapter with one character and went to the other, I was like, oh, can we just stay with them for a little longer? I want to know what's going to happen.
Saba Tahir with her cliffhangers. It was basically every chapter was a cliffhanger.
Which is why I stayed up till like 2 a.m. reading, because like Elias is literally on a chopping block about to die. And I was like, gotta find out what happens. Like, I know it's 2 a.m, but like, I got to know.
But it doesn't matter.
It didn't matter. I just, it was so good. So good.
So fast paced. Yes. Wanted to keep reading for sure.
Those chapter cliffhangers. Yeah, that's what it was.
I see what you're doing. Yeah. Okay, I see you.
You keep me reading. Mm-hmm. She did good. I thought it was great.
I appreciated the character development even for villains like Karis.
Yeah.
I think you got to see the depths of the darkness rather than just telling you she's bad. Right. It shows you how bad she is.
Writer, show, don't tell.
Exactly.
Golden rule in writing.
And Helene, who you could easily just see as a villain because you're so rooting for Elias and Lya.
Right. But the characters are really well developed in this story. And I think we get good character arcs with the smaller characters like Izzy or Kanan, like, they're important to the story, but their roles are much smaller. I don't think we always see side characters get story arcs, and I really, really like that.
Yeah, I appreciate that it's not just focused on, like, your one chosen one.
Yeah, exactly. Two chosen ones.
Two chosen ones.
Two chosen ones.
Having multiple protagonists is fun. I really enjoy the multiple POV. YA, multiple POV.
I do, too. It's, like, one of my favorites. Unless it's poorly written, and then I'm like,
eh. I'm excited for you to read Six of Crows, then.
Recommend if you like. I think if you like this book, you'll like Throne of Glass, probably Game of Thrones.
Any assassin school book?
Yeah, I can't think of a good assassin school book at the moment.
I mean, Throne of Glass is kind of that.
Yeah, it is kind of that. Although I haven't read Assassin's Blade still.
Neither have I.
Oh, okay, good.
It's on the list.
Yeah, it's on. I have it. It's in a pile of books over there. Yeah, and strong female characters.
So many of them.
Yeah, even the ones who start off as seem like more meek or mild, like Lya, they become so strong in the end, and I really, really like that.
I appreciate a good character arc.
You'll get a strong female character the whole way through in Throne of Glass, though. Mm. Just a warning.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for discussion of Siege and Storm by Leigh Bardugo, the second book in the Grishaverse series. And watch out for more mini-sodes about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics.
You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Podcasts, and Stitcher. We'd really appreciate if you would rate and review the show. JK It's Magic is recorded on lands traditionally belonging to the Ute, Cheyenne, and Arapaho Native peoples. See you in a fortnight.